From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made Monday night in a stretch of about 50,000 miles in the darkness of space. Those 50,000 miles were covered in a matter of mere seconds as NASA's DART mission spacecraft completed its journey straight into the face of an asteroid. And we got to watch the entire event in full unfold on camera. NPR called it a huge first for our planetary defense strategy and a move straight out of a sci-fi movie. This was the culmination of the NASA project known as the Double Asteroid Redirection Test, aka DART. The price tag of $300 million will eventually seem modest if this mission helps us one day deflect an oncoming asteroid from our path. The DART spacecraft launched last November on a voyage to answer some questions for scientists. First, how good are we at sending our own spacecrafts to collide with moving targets? Second, can we do enough damage to blow an object off course? We got the first answer on Monday night, and it was a massive success. The second answer won't come for a number of weeks, it seems, although we'll talk about that. And to be clear, the asteroid targeted this week, again, it was not on a collision course with us. Far from it. This is just a test mission, should we ever need the real thing in a short amount of time. Let's talk about it with our guest this hour. Dr. David DeGraff is with us. Dr. DeGraff is a professor of physics and astronomy at Alfred University. David, thank you for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Dr. Roger Duby, who is a physicist and an emeritus professor at RIT. Roger, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan. Good to be here.
And Dr. Brian Koberline, an astrophysicist and a science writer with the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. Brian, welcome back to you.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Brian, were you geeking out like I was watching live on Monday night?
This is straight out of science fiction. I love this stuff.
So, yes, the answer is obviously yes, you were.
Yes.
And can I ask you, Brian, were you surprised at all at the level of success? And again, the success in that we could see it happen. We could see it in real time, and we know that we made contact. Was there ever a doubt in your mind that that's what we were going to see on Monday?
I would say not a realistic doubt. I mean, we have very trained people that do this stuff, and it amazes me every time that they carry it off. You know, I'm glad I'm not on the team because I would probably screw it up.
Roger Duby, were you watching Monday night?
Indeed, yes.
What did you think?
I was pleased. I kind of like Brian, I felt that I wasn't going to be surprised that it was going to be a direct hit because this is the team's lifeblood. And to be honest, the mission of being able to deflect an oncoming asteroid is very critical. And so we can't minimize the importance of this effort. So they had to get it right for many reasons.
David DeGraff, what about you?
I was definitely watching it and watching those two little tiny dots grow larger and larger and the big one drift off the side of the screen as we headed towards the little one. It was so thrilling. And I was not worried that NASA was going to miss. This was a very simple craft. It just had a camera and thrusters was pretty much all that there was to it. So there weren't any mechanical parts that could really go wrong with it. So I wasn't worried.
I hope everybody listening can appreciate the implications of saying, you know, I really didn't think NASA would miss. This was pretty straightforward. You know, we all played Galaga growing up. This is basically the same thing.
Well, but compared to the Mars rover landing,
yes,
this was really simple.
Much simpler than Mars rover, sure. So before we kind of get more granular, I want to ask one question, though, that goes to the second prong of this mission. Again, the first prong is just making contact, hitting this moving target. And then the second prong is really knocking it off course. And I want to read from some of NPR's reporting here, because as I heard this report, I wondered if there's at least a little bit of a premature celebration here. Quote, scientists say the craft made impact with its intended target, an egg-shaped asteroid named Dimorphos, as planned, though it will be about 2 months before they can fully determine whether the hit was enough to actually drive the asteroid off course. Nonetheless, NASA officials have hailed the mission as an unprecedented success. And then they quote Lindley Johnson, NASA's planetary defense officer, in a statement, quote, DART's success provides a significant addition to the essential toolbox we must have to protect Earth from a devastating impact by an asteroid. This demonstrates we are no longer powerless to prevent this type of natural disaster. End quote. And what I would ask, David, is how do you know that last part? We don't know that yet, do we?
We don't know if we can be successful in moving it. It seems like it was definitely a solid impact. The monitoring that we did from the ground, we could see the asteroid get much brighter during the impact. We could see debris spraying off from the impact. So we did something. How much it deflected it is the question. We can deflect them. It has changed its course. We can be pretty sure of that. But by how much is what the question really is.
Okay, Roger Doobie, do you feel like the last statement from NASA there is a little too soon to tell that we can, and again, I'll read it again, this demonstrates we are no longer powerless to prevent this type of natural disaster?
Well, there are a couple of points there. First, I'd say that this is basically a Newtonian kinematics calculation, so there's no real reason to be surprised that this thing was successful. I think it will be a matter of confirming how much the deflection was, how that compares to the calculations that we would do. So everybody is pretty much comfortable, and it's a question of, you know, well, how far off did we deflect this, and is it something that we can rely upon? In terms of jumping to the conclusion of now we're no longer powerless to protect the Earth, that's a pretty sweeping statement. We don't know that far in advance whether or not there is a planet killer, which is a very large asteroid that we'd have to deal with, the kind of things that Hollywood likes to make movies about. And that would be a significantly bigger problem, because that is a very, very massive asteroid, would have a big job ahead of us. So to sit back and say, okay, we're all good now, I think is kind of jumping the gun a little bit. I think we do have the ability to handle smaller near-Earth objects that might be coming to hit us. Whether or not I would say, hey, no problem anymore, I think is a little too soon.
Before I turn to Brian, let me just follow up one point there. First of all, with NASA's statement, I have to imagine that some of that is the pressure of having $300 million spent in the last 9 months on this project, and you want to justify it. But I would just say, NASA, we are all behind you. If this was a total dud, it's okay. It's still a good use of the money. We have to know what works and what doesn't. But Roger, to your point about the size of these things, and yes, Hollywood likes to focus on sort of the planet killers, but this was a mission that aimed at the smaller of two. That's why I think that's where the title, the double asteroid redirection test.
Yes. How
big was the small one that NASA hit? And do we know roughly that whatever size that was, if it made contact with Earth, what kind of damage it would do?
Well, it was about 300 feet in size, so the size of a football field. Those types of asteroids hitting the Earth will make a lot of noise, have a pretty spectacular entry. They may or may not hit land. Remember that most of the Earth is water, so the threat is already reduced just by that. In terms of how much damage a 300-foot asteroid would do, that's not something I have at the tip of my
fingers. But it's not a planet killer.
A planet killer is 60 miles in diameter, so that's bigger than the state of Rhode Island. This was 300 feet, so it's a lot smaller than a planet killer.
Okay, and Roger, the larger of the two objects that NASA did not target is significantly bigger. I don't know if it's in that 60-mile category, but it's significantly bigger than the little guy.
Well, it's bigger. It's bigger enough that the little guy is orbiting around the thing. The center Didymus is about 1,300 feet, so it's four times bigger. But it's nowhere near a planet killer, which again is 60 miles in diameter. So that, those are big asteroids.
Okay, so now, Brian Koberline, now I'm feeling somewhat deflated. Now we've got a 300-foot asteroid that we may or may not have knocked off course, and it may or may not even get to the surface of Earth if it ever got here. So this is not even in the realm of a planet-busting nightmare scenario. I don't mean to sort of throw a wet towel on this, but help me out here.
Well, I think you have to keep in mind that even though the planet-busting idea is great for Hollywood, it's not really our biggest threat. The bigger a rock is, the easier it is to see. The little asteroid in this case is probably in the same general range as the asteroid that hit Russia a while back, Chelyabinsk, I think. So it was an airburst. It caused some damage on the ground, but it didn't devastate a city, and it wasn't a threat to the entire planet. But it's still a risk. And the larger one could definitely do damage. It could kill a million people, depending on if it hit the right spot. So these are in the range of meteors that could do damage, and certainly on the larger end, something that could do significant damage that we would not want to hit the Earth in a populated area.
Okay, I think that's a really important point here, that the Hollywood-style huge ones, while that could happen, and I guess, Brian, do we know how big the one that wiped out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago was?
You're asking me the question I should know and don't remember specifically.
Roger, but you had those numbers at hand. Do you have it?
Actually, I do not have that one.
We're going to fact-check the scientists. Go ahead.
That's right. Keep in mind that, you know, the dinosaurs were not wiped out by a planet-killer asteroid, because a planet-killer, by definition, wipes out all life on Earth. That was a particular species or subspecies that got wiped out by that asteroid. So it was nowhere near as big as a planet killer anyway, just FYI.
Okay, that's fair enough. But I think Brian's point, and correct me if I'm wrong, Brian, is that yes, that would be a nightmare scenario, but more likely over time, and what we're talking about over time is hundreds and then thousands and literally even millions of years, is the likelihood of smaller, possibly devastating to regions or cities or, you know, or land masses, but not necessarily extinction level events. And those still really matter. And we have to find a way to deal with those too. Is that fair?
Yes, that's correct. Anything that would be probably in that kind of city killer size is the thing that is much more common. And taking out a city isn't nothing. It's huge. It's devastating.
Okay. So let's talk now about how this actually happened. This was what, I think it launched in last November, so we're talking the better part of a year to get there. And can I ask all three of you, kind of help us understand what you'd want the public to understand about just how impressive this is? I mean, David, you seem totally unimpressed because this wasn't a rover mission, but I'm mostly kidding there, but I'm blown away by this. 9 months to prepare, to find the object, to get there, to get there sort of unencumbered, that we could still see pictures. Can you talk a little bit about the mission itself?
I didn't mean to underplay it. it was absolutely beautiful and inspiring. But we were, the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs was about 6 miles across. We wanted to make sure we could deflect an asteroid. The ones that we could get to the fast are the ones that are closest to us. And if we just had tried to attack a single asteroid, there could be a small chance that we deflected part of it or sent off debris from it that would impact the Earth, and then we'd be in trouble. So we sent it to a double asteroid and attacked the moon. So we're just changing the orbit of the moon around the main asteroid, and there's no chance that it would deflect the path of the whole thing so that it could hit us. And those planet killers, we've been searching for the last 20 years. We've had a bunch of automated telescopes that take multiple pictures of the entire sky every night. And those have been finding asteroids faster than anything. And so we know that there is not a planet killer asteroid out there. We're pretty confident that we're safe from that. It's the small city killer size that are the ones that are too faint for us to see. So that's what we're after. And so by looking at how this is going, we can determine how much things have been deflected.
Yeah, and David, that's where I would, just as part of the lay public, have a lot more confidence that we're going to get better at this, only because, you know, a generation ago, we knew very little about exoplanets. And now we can see, through better technology and understanding, so much more about what is out there, to say nothing of Webb, et cetera. Just in terms of understanding what is out there and detection, we are getting much better at detecting, aren't we?
Yes, we're getting much better. I discovered a couple of asteroids back in the late 90s before the robots started doing it, and it was laborious work, pouring through images. And but since then, the automated telescopes are just banging them out, and the first asteroid I discovered got numbered at 13,000 something, and now we're over 500,000 numbered asteroids.
Wow. So, just absolutely remarkable stuff. And Roger Duby, to that point, you know, seeing a lot more of what is out there, it's like turning the light on in a dark room. But there has been, in the last few days, some reaction to this mission that sounds a little bit like this. Well, this is the kind of thing you would do if you knew there was something coming our way, but you didn't want people to panic yet. I don't think there's any evidence of that, but do you want to dispel any such concerns? Do you have any concerns, Roger, that they're going to announce next week? Well, we had to do this because we actually do have something coming our way.
No, we don't have anything, quote, on the radar that's heading our way.
Yeah.
We do. JPL has a database that they continually update that has anything that's a near-Earth object that could potentially come close to us, and that includes things that actually could threaten us. So there's nothing there in the foreseeable future that's coming really close. There are asteroids that will be passing between the Earth and the Moon. And one of them in particular is, I believe, going to actually be as close to the Earth as some of the orbits of the spacecraft that we have around the Earth. So these things do get kind of chillingly close if you really want to stop and think about it. But we do have systems in place now to monitor the sky, do the calculations of orbital dynamics so we know which way things are going, and therefore be able to confidently predict whether or not something is going to be coming really close to us and is threatening. The asteroid that we hit with this spacecraft was actually discovered back in 1996 by a team at Kitt Peak. So we've known about this thing for quite a while. And so the fact that it took us 9 months to mount this mission does tell us that if something were to pop up in the database suddenly to say, oh my God, there's a big thing coming, it is going to take us a number of months to get a mission in place properly so that we can hit this thing and try to knock it off course. But that said, we do have this active database connected to the Sky Survey that is keeping a close eye on things. So there really should not be any surprises. This is sort of an early warning system now.
It's amazing. That alone, we've known about this since 96, and we just went and collided with it on Monday night. It's just an amazing set of facts and frankly, capabilities. But now, Brian Koberlein, looking ahead to the next 4, 8, 12 weeks, when we really try to figure out how much we've affected it, what does success look like in your own mind as a scientist, Brian? You would call the second half of that mission actually altering its course a success, if what?
If we can pin down the amount that it's done, I think one thing that's really important to understand is that the amount that it changes is not as important as the fact that it does change. Because the thing about deflecting these types of asteroids is that the more lead time we have, the less we have to change the trajectory. You know, if I'm running towards you at a full tilt and you deflect me very slightly 100 yards from you, I completely miss you.
Mm-hmm.
But if I do it when you're 10 feet away, I'm probably still going to hit you. So even if we're doing it at centimeters per second, half a centimeter per second, anything like that, if it's far enough out, that's enough. That's enough to miss the Earth. All you need is a small deflection early enough.
That's such an important point here, because I've definitely been part of the public thinking, well, you got to really blow this thing. You know, you got to hit it hard to knock it off course. But that's important. So the earlier detection we have, the farther away we can get to these things, the less damage we have to do. Now, having said that, let me get to some of our feedback from listeners. Not the least of which is our listeners who are asking, well, why not hit it with something harder? Here's Roger, not Roger Doobie, different Roger, who says, greetings, Evan and Megan. I don't understand how an object the size of a refrigerator could affect the trajectory of a huge asteroid. I would think it would take something with the energy of a good-sized nuclear missile to have any meaningful impact. Have a wonderful day. That is from Roger. So, Brian, can you elaborate on the point you were just making and then maybe address Roger's point that, yes, you don't have to deflect it that much, but if you have a little refrigerator bouncing into a big object, why not hit it with something harder?
Well, I think one of the things is that this satellite hit the asteroid at about 4 miles per second. And with that, it released an energy roughly equivalent to about 3 tons of TNT. If you're hitting something at high speed, then that's the energy that matters, because this basically half a ton satellite moving so fast hits with plenty of energy. The other thing you want to be careful about is that if you hit it with too much energy, the thing could just fragment. You know, we don't know like how tightly packed these asteroids are. And you don't want it, if you're trying to deflect a satellite, asteroid, you don't want to just shatter it into a bunch of little rocks that then definitely come down and hit us all. So smaller can be better if you catch it early enough.
Okay. Roger Doobie, what would you say to the emailer, Roger, who's saying, why not hit it harder?
Well, again, I think echoing Brian's analogy of the further you are, the earlier you hit this thing, the easier job it is. I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. And the other point is that this is really all about changing the momentum of things. And so you've got a mass and you've got a speed. We've got this small refrigerator that we're throwing at this thing, but we're throwing it at over 14,000 miles an hour. And the combination of mass times speed gives you that amount of TNT equivalent that makes this a very significant impact for this particular asteroid. We can do that calculation in advance and determine what it's going to take to knock this thing appreciably off course so that it misses the Earth. And it's going to be a combination of how big is this thing, how much time do we have to get a spacecraft out there, how much distance do we have away from Earth, and therefore what speed do we have to hit that object with? And so it's several different variables that all have to be factored in. And I understand Roger's point, and all I would say is that we do have to consider all of those factors. And so there may very well be a situation with a large asteroid where we need something significantly more energetic, on the order of a nuclear bomb type of energy. But hopefully that won't be something that we really have to mount a mission to slam something that hard. Again, Brian's point is you don't want to bust it up into a bunch of little pieces, because the center of mass continues following the initial trajectory, and now you've got a spray that's going to hit all over the place, including Earth. And you don't want to cross that line, because you've kind of worked against yourself.
Yeah. You can be too successful in a strange way there. So as I turn to David DeGraff on this, let me read two emails from listeners. First, Charles says, I don't see how this plan can work when there are so many people in government working to stop oil drilling. No one's going to know how to do Bruce Willis's job. So for those who haven't seen Armageddon, back in the day when DVDs would be released, sometimes there would be director's commentary, and there is a legendary bit of inebriated commentary from Ben Affleck, who was an actor in the movie, who mused that Hollywood decided they would make a movie about, you know, one of these planet killers coming our way, and the center plot point of the movie is that it would be easier to teach drillers to become astronauts than it would be to teach astronauts to become drillers. Now, that is not to demean the science and the skill in drilling, but a rather inebriated Ben Affleck thought that that was an interesting choice. But anyway, Bruce Willis was the driller, and Charles is saying, you know, you got to have someone to do Bruce Willis's job. That's a very funny email, Charles, as always. But the question, I think, becomes, do you ever foresee a scenario where you got to put people on? And Patrick says this. Patrick wants to know about sort of a similar issue. He says, I can understand a large enough impact pushing something closer to an orbiting body. With something larger, it was my understanding that a vehicle lands and then uses thrusters to push and maintain an asteroid trajectory so that it misses the Earth rather than run into it and make a whole bunch of debris come off of it. But all of that debris just sprays right back at us. Well, that's exactly what Brian and Roger were just saying. You don't want to just blow the thing into bits that continue on the same path. Now you've got a bunch coming our way, and who knows what's going to happen there. But both of what Patrick and Charles are saying, somewhat cheekily on Charles' side there, David, is that do we have to land and then deploy in any certain way? Or is this always going to be a mission in which we are just kind of crashing into and trying to deflect?
There are a lot of different plans that we've had for deflecting things. All of them are, I want to say low impact, but low impact ideas. We could hit it hard with a refrigerator, and that's going to push it a little bit out of the way. We could land and use thrusters, as was it Peter was saying? That has been one of the plans. Another plan has been to cover the asteroid in white paint, and then the extra sunlight that's bouncing off of the asteroid would be enough to deflect it if we had enough time on that case.
Hold on a second. is that a somewhat serious and workable idea?
The amount of paint you would need would be very large. and deploying it, I'm not sure we've got what kind of paint gun you would need to
That's
cover
an amazing
the
idea.
Asteroid. But that is another possibility. But the hard part, we haven't been very successful on landing on these small bodies.
Mm-hmm.
In order to land, we usually count on gravity to be able to hold us there, but the gravity on the asteroids is not strong enough. We tried landing on a comet. There was the Philae lander on a comet mission, tried landing on a comet, and it was gonna, as it made contact, it shot out a harpoon to anchor it to the ground, but the harpoon didn't stick. So the lander bounced, and it took an hour to go up and an hour to come back down, and then it bounced a third time, and it was the fourth time it finally landed on its side on the bottom of a cliff in the shade, and it was solar powered, so we didn't get too much out of that. And there was another mission where it was just a brief touchdown on an asteroid where we were able to pick up some of the rocks, and that's on its way back to Earth right now. But actually landing there and staying and having the thrusters pointing in the right direction is an extremely difficult maneuver that we haven't been successful at yet. We're really good at just head in that direction and go, and just bump into it and knock it out of the way.
This is amazing to me. Roger Doobie, how do you like the idea of painting one of these things white and letting the sun do its damage?
I was thinking about it. You know, there's a comedian, and I was trying to remember his or her name, who once said, it's a small world, but I wouldn't want to paint it. that's exactly what we're talking about here. The surface area of an asteroid and trying to paint it white is a really tall order. Better be damn confident that this is really going to work in terms of the calculation for, photon pressure pushing this thing out of the way. I have mixed feelings about that.
What I like,
yeah, that's
yeah.
Good job.
What I like, Brian Koberlein, is the fact that clearly, just the fact that this idea was in the mix, there are really intelligent people thinking about everything. I mean, every possible angle here, even if they're not viable, and that actually gives me some comfort, Brian. I don't know how you feel about it.
Yeah, I mean, part of the thing of engineers trying to do this thing is really come up with all the wild ideas you possibly can and then rule out the ones that won't work. So whenever you hear these types of crazy ideas, they might work. I mean, if we think about it, let's fire a bullet in an asteroid and change its course. Sounds like a crazy idea, but we actually carried it off.
I mean, that's like 1/100th as crazy as painting it, but I still think it's all pretty crazy. This is So after we take our only break of the hour, we're going to continue with some feedback from listeners. If you've got questions, comments, as we talk to folks in the field of science about what they are seeing on this really amazing week in which NASA makes contact with this asteroid. The DART mission, at least the first part of it, is a big success. And maybe you watched it live Monday night. Maybe you saw the thing up close. I thought that was one of the most amazing parts myself, is when it finally, in those final seconds, when it made contact and you could see the surface of that asteroid. Just wild stuff. So, but if you've got questions, comments, we'll take them by email, connections@wxxi.org, or you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. My guests include David DeGraff. Dr. DeGraff is a professor of physics and astronomy at Alfred University. Roger Duby. Dr. Duby is a physicist and emeritus professor at RIT. Brian Koberlein. Dr. Koberlein is an astrophysicist and a science writer with the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. We are right back with them next. Coming up in our second hour, we stick with the theme of science in this previously recorded edition of Connections. We welcome an astrophysicist along with a couple of students who are on their way to becoming scientists. It's the second in a series of conversations on what it means to learn about becoming a scientist. How do you learn to think? How do you deal with criticism from peers? And how can we all apply those lessons in our lives? That's next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and I'm wondering if Dr. David DeGraff will just indulge me a couple of questions that are kind of, deflections, to borrow the phrase of the day. And we'll get back to the DART mission in a moment. But David, you're part of the upcoming event known as Astronomicon, right?
Yes, I am.
Remind listeners what Astronomicon is.
Astronomicon is a science fiction convention that's been going on in Rochester for at least 30 years, probably longer than that. It's going to be at the first weekend in November, and I'm going to be talking about the James Webb Telescope and exoplanets, and I'm going to be doing some reading from my own fiction. There's also going to be talks on different aspects of fandom, science fiction fandom, television shows, discussions of different books also. And there's a bunch of science fiction writers that are going to be there, several different scientists that are going to be there. So it's got a wide range of things that are happening there.
Astronomicon is November 4th through the 6th, and they're going to just looking down the list of subjects, Fermi's Paradox, always a favorite for me. But then there's So You Want to Be a Writer, Meet the Professionals, all kinds of different science fiction discussions on themes in science fiction, how it's changed, some famous texts. There's going to be readings. And it looks, as they put it themselves, like all kinds of nerdy fun. What do you love most about it, David?
I love just being around other people and being surrounded by science fiction fans who are really excited about science fiction and the science that's in there and all the different aspects of it. It's a great chance to meet people.
And there's an entire session on genre shows you should be watching but probably aren't. So that gives me a chance to ask all three of our guests. You can pick either a show or a book that you think is some of the best in the realm of science fiction. What would you say, David, that people haven't consumed, they should consume this, a show or a book?
I'm going to go with The Expanse TV series.
There you go.
And it's also it's based on a book by S.A. Corey. Leviathan Wakes was the first novel in that series. And that, the way it depicts space is extremely realistic and a lot of fun.
Roger Doobie, what about you?
So I'm kind of old school in this category. Foundation Trilogy by Isaac Asimov is my absolute go-to. I would recommend that to anyone that would like a taste of science fiction. It's sort of timeless. It is very focused on the frailties and strengths of human nature, kind of cast within a science fiction world that is also engaging just by itself. So that is absolutely my recommendation.
Brian Koberlein.
I have been watching For All Mankind, which is telling the story of basically if the Apollo mission and the space race continued, what if the Russians got to the moon? What if we kept going all the way out to Mars eventually? And it's a fun show. It draws on a lot of the kind of historical plans of if we kept the large budget for NASA, what would we have done in the 80s? What would we have done in the 90s? So I'm getting a lot of fun out of that one.
All right, we're going to get back to why we're here this hour. We're talking about NASA's DART mission, the success they've seen this week, and what they hope to learn in the weeks to come about the effort of deflecting an asteroid, not one that is currently on track for our planet, but for the purposes of learning whether they could, in the future, deflect an object that was coming our way. Listener says, glad the mission was a success. What are the ethical implications of shifting the track of the asteroid where it could potentially smash into another life-bearing planet? Now, normally, I would say it is always valuable to ask about the ethical implications of actions that we take as human beings to protect ourselves on this planet, if those actions could impact other species, other forms of life, and then asking, you know, how far are you willing to go? In this case, I mean, I understand the question, but just going back to Fermi's paradox here, I don't know it seems to me, Brian Koberlein, that the likelihood of deflecting an asteroid that's going to hit you and making sure it doesn't hit you, and then it continues on its merry way and eventually crashes into a planet that is life-bearing, that seems to me like hitting the lottery a trillion times in a row. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I mean, the chances of that are really small. Any asteroid that we deflect is not going to be kicked out of our solar system because of this deflection. It orbits the sun. We're changing the orbit very slightly to still orbit the sun. So if it hit anything, it would hit something in our solar system. And as far as we know right now, there isn't any life anywhere else in our solar system.
That's really important. Roger Doobie, anything to add there?
No, I agree with that completely. I would say that we don't know for sure whether or not there's life elsewhere in our solar system. That's to prove existence like that is a tall order. You really have to find something to show, yep, there's life here somewhere. To prove the negative of that is much harder. To say that there's no life anywhere in the solar system is a very sweeping conclusion, and that's not an easy thing to prove. All of that said, I think that the point is fair. I think that we do need to consider at some level the eventual impact of a diverted asteroid if it seems like it could potentially hit something else. So, for example, what happens if we knock it off course and it hits the moon and we have a moon base or something like that. Following your streaming of For All Mankind, Brian, that's the kind of thing that I would be thinking about. Not so much another planet, but how about something else where we actually have a group of people already living there, the moon or Mars. Those things would be big concerns to me.
Yeah, and this is where David DeGraff, our engineer Rob Braden, sends me a note that says the butterfly effect, and that's right. I mean, the unintended consequences mm-hmm. are hard to predict here. My understanding of the likelihood of this one bopping into life out there, the universe is so big and so vast and so currently cold and lifeless beyond us that I think this consideration is well placed, but I'm not sure it's a realistic one. What do you think?
The chance of it of deflecting anything to hit Mars that could hit Earth, if something were deflecting something away from Earth, the chance of it, there's absolutely zero chance that it would be able to hit Mars, changing it for that. That's really small. The moon might be a problem if we have moon bases. But the thing to worry about is, could someone weaponize this? And instead of deflecting an asteroid away from the Earth, deflect it towards the Earth. And that is something that we might be concerned about if we start having more people living in space and moving around. But it's really easy to make something miss. It's on track to hit you. Making it miss is really easy. Deflecting it by exactly the right amount to make it hit you. And these things are just rubble piles. They're not solid objects. They're loosely bound rocks. And so pushing a pile of stuff without having it go apart would be difficult. But when you brought up the butterfly effect, there are some asteroids that are going to pass close to the Earth. I don't have the dates handy to me. But if it comes closer, then if it comes at just the wrong distance, the Earth's gravity will deflect the asteroid enough so that the next time it comes around, it will hit us. Right now, it looks like it's not going to hit that right track. And it's only about a 10-mile wide path near the Earth where it's going to be just the right path and it's going to deflect us to hit us. If it's closer than that, the Earth is going to deflect it a lot more, and it's going to miss us by more than the moon's distance the next time around. If it's farther away than that just wrong distance, then it's going to keep on missing us for the foreseeable future. But making something hit us on purpose is a very difficult task to do.
Yeah. Thank you for the email. Let me get a phone call from John and Henrietta with a really good question here. Hi, John, go ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting because I put the call in before you started talking about the moon, because my concern would be, what if an asteroid hits the moon, changes its orbit? That's going to change the Earth's orbit, isn't it? Have we any evidence of that? I mean, it's all pockmarked, our moon.
No, the moon has been hit by things throughout its history. You can look at the moon through a pair of binoculars and see the craters that are there. The moon has an enormous mass. An asteroid hitting the moon, we think of something with a mass of a million tons as being really heavy, but relative to the mass of the moon, that's very small. So it's not going to change the orbit of the moon, space 1999 style. There's an explosion on the far side of the moon that sends the moon off through interstellar space. I even as a kid, that show bothered me.
Now, if we did lose the moon, we would lose our lives, wouldn't we? Because wouldn't that pretty much change the balance in our
Earth? That would affect the tides. The Earth's orbit would not be seriously affected by that. If for some chance the moon got destroyed or
shifted out of Earth's orbit. The Earth would be pretty much okay. Civilization would have to adjust because we wouldn't have tides anymore, or tides would be a lot weaker without the moon. So we'd have to worry about that. But the entire life on Earth would be okay.
John, these are good questions. These are questions I was wondering about. And now I feel like, you know, I could take or leave the moon. I thought it was much more important than the Roger Doobie. Should I be worried about the moon?
I don't think so. Again, I think the point that the moon's mass is so large that it's probably not going to be affected is probably where we can take the most comfort. I would like to mention that there's a website, jpl.nasa.gov/asteroidwatch, that I would recommend viewers that are interested take a look at, because that has, for example, the next five closest approaches. It tells you how big these asteroids are, how close to Earth they're going to come, and so on. So you can get kind of a view of what they're seeing these days. Kind of an interesting little thing to look at instead of looking at the news.
That's always better. Brian, are you worried about the moon?
No, I love these kinds of questions in student classes and stuff, because you go, well, if it hits the moon, is it going to change its orbit? Is it going to change Earth's orbit? The answer is yes, in the same way that if a mosquito hits my windshield, it does slow my car down a very, very tiny bit. I'm not worried about it, though.
Gotcha. Very interesting. There's a really good feed on social media that a listener sent me of a guy who was just watching the Monday Night Live feed, and this is just watching a layperson blown away by the science, and he concludes, 7 million miles away, and they hit an asteroid just 500 feet in diameter with basically a flying jukebox. It's amazing. It's amazing what happened. And as we get ready to wrap here, I want to ask our guests what the next most important mission is, or maybe something else that's happening that hasn't made headlines yet that they are excited about. Brian, what's on your list of we need to know more about X, or I can't wait until the public hears about Y?
I would say, for me, this impact is being observed by lots of other observatories, including things like radio observatories and stuff. We're going to get data from things like ALMA and other observatories that look at not just how much the position has changed or how much the motion has changed, but also things like the composition. And the subsequent mission of Hera is going to look at how much the asteroids have deformed. Do they change shape because of this impact, as well as the orbital changes? So there's still a lot coming out of this mission already.
Great stuff. Roger Doobie, what's on the list of, whether connected to this or totally unrelated, that you are eager to learn more about?
So one thing that I've been watching and have been trying to make the public more aware of are coronal mass ejections. So this is in a totally orthogonal direction. We're not talking about asteroids. We're talking about activity on the surface of the sun, where suddenly a huge amount of material gets blown off the surface of the sun. And in some cases, these coronal mass ejections can be emitted so that they will hit the Earth. Actually, in the show For All Mankind, there's an episode where a coronal mass ejection hits the moon colony, and it talks about the impact of that. What they miss is that one of the biggest threats of a CME hitting the Earth is actually on the power grid, which is very susceptible to huge pulses of currents like that. And the last one that we saw, the Carrington event, was dramatic, but we were not advanced enough yet to be as severely impacted. I worry a fair amount about CMEs.
David DeGraff?
I'm not worried about death. I'm worried. What I'm really excited about is we are preparing to send some new spacecraft to Venus. And we recently, there was a little bit of controversy recently. Someone claimed that they found signs of life in the clouds of Venus. Venus's surface is hotter than an oven. It can melt lead and aluminum, but the clouds of Venus are higher up, and those are a nice temperature.
And there's a little bit of sulfuric acid in them, and that could be used as a food source for life in the clouds of Venus. And we're sending a mission there to take another look, a closer look, and see if we can find signs of chemical activity that's going, unusual chemical activity that's going on in the atmosphere of Venus. So that's exciting me. And also, Jupiter's moon Europa has liquid oceans beneath its icy surface. And there's a mission proposed to sample the ice. We're going to send a little cannonball into the surface of Europa that'll spray up some of the debris and then catch that and bring it back to Earth and see if there's any signs of life going on there. That's what's exciting me now.
This is always just absolutely remarkable to me that we are capable of this. Again, if I had to repopulate this planet, I mean, there would just be no scientific advances for about 1,000 years. You could give me every textbook. It's amazing. It's amazing what happens, and I'm so glad that we've had our guests helping explain it to us. Dr. David DeGraff from Alfred University. David, thank you for making time for the program. Come back sometime.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Roger Doobie, a physicist and emeritus professor at RIT. Thank you, Roger.
Thank you very much, Evan. I always enjoy it.
Always appreciate having you and Dr. Brian Koberlein. Brian's an astrophysicist and a science writer with the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. Thanks as always, Brian.
Thank you very much.
And more science talk headed in a little bit of a different direction coming up on our next hour on Connections.